Red Film Radio, I'm Matt McCucci from the 59th Cork Film Festival, joined by filmmaker Terry McMahon, who's presenting his film Patrick's Day here at the festival. And thanks very much for taking the time off and talking with us.
Pleasure, Matt.
I guess the best way to start off the interview would be to tell our listeners a little bit about the story of the film.
It's a young kid with mental health issues who goes on an annual pilgrimage to Dublin with his mother on St. Patrick's Day. He was born on March 17th and his name is Patrick. And they've been doing it since he was a child. He's 25 now. And she's kept him kind of infantilized. She's kept him very young. But this 25th birthday year, he gets separated from his mother. And when he goes back to the hotel, he meets an older suicidal flight attendant who is going to kill herself that night up in the room upstairs. And before she decides to do that, she will pick anybody just to delay the inevitable and have sex with him one last time. She happens to pick him. It changes his life. It stops her killing herself. But it also causes his obsessive mother to go insanely protective, because she believes that his mental condition would be exacerbated by matters of the heart. So she enlists the help of a dodgy cop to try and separate the two of them, and then uses his mental illness against him to try and convince him that in fact it was a delusion, that it never happened. So it's about the right to intimacy, and it's about the difference between what's real and what's not, and who decides those things.
Right. And I guess the obligatory question to follow up on that is, where did the inspiration for this story come from?
I used to work in a psychiatric institution as a trainee many, many years ago. And at the weekends, the parents or guardians or family members of the patients, as they were called, would come and visit. And they were always loving, always open, always warm, until the patients would demonstrate an aspiration toward intimacy, or even more so, a yearning for sexuality or sexual engagement. And suddenly, those aspirations were treated like they were an aberration, a dangerous aberration, and somehow as if it was a case of their mental state was negative and destructive and wrong, and they were treated with the kind of moral fascistic imposition of somebody who was given the authority to decide what's right and what's not. So I remember at the time thinking that I'd love to write something about that moral authority, that fascistic moral notion that you can decide who's entitled to what and why.
The way in which you deal with schizophrenia was well researched from personal experiences too. It's a very delicate issue, obviously, to deal with.
Well, one of the things that I think is imperative in the film is that we're not claiming to be experts on schizophrenia, for example. The diagnosis of schizophrenia can be reductionist and can be damaging to an individual, we all know that, but it can also be a diagnosis that's completely accurate, and the beneficial elements of the therapies that are brought forward, from pharmaceuticals to whatever, can be massively beneficial. So this is not an anti-psychiatric movie, nor is it a fairy tale notion of schizophrenia either. The broader notion of who has the right to intimacy, for me, is a massively central drive that, for example, we've seen until very recently, homosexuality was deemed to be an aberration. Homosexuality was illegal as well as an aberration. So in terms of basic morality and in terms of basic law, it was an obscenity. And that's until very recently. I can't comprehend that we existed in a realm, a recent realm, where we had the moral ugliness to impose that authority upon other people. Now, thankfully, society has changed, but society has changed because of a magnificently proactive campaign from the gay community that became an umbrella or a rainbow community, LGBT, and they were the most successful campaigners imaginable. So they shifted our moral compass in a humanistic direction. They were brilliantly effective, but people who are suffering from mental health don't, as individuals or as a collective, have that power or sway at all. And I love the idea of what's it like to be in a situation where we have a central character who, in a reductionist sense, is one thing, but in a humanistic sense could be an extraordinary thing.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, even the story is very universal, can be universally understood, this need of intimacy, but also the characters themselves, they're very human and very real and very alive, and it seems like this rings true in the performances too. They're absolutely amazing. So how did you actually work with the actors to achieve that?
Well, with Kerry Fox, I saw Kerry Fox in Jane Campion's movie An Angel at My Table, yeah, well over 20 years ago. And I thought it was one of the greatest performances in the history of cinema. I rarely ever witnessed something that affected me so profoundly. And Carrie Fox was an unknown at the time. She would subsequently become one of the great actors of her generation. But we're talking about a relatively low-budget film here. And I said to the casting agent, Rebecca Roper, what are the chances of getting a Carrie Fox type? I didn't say Carrie Fox because I knew we had no hope in hell of getting Carrie Fox, but a Carrie Fox type. And the casting agent says, if you write her a letter, I can get it to her. Agent. Carrie Fox read the letter, read the script, and within 24 hours said yes to the film. And that staggered me because her audacity, the sheer courage of her decision to dive into a completely unknown filmmaker's world in a completely potentially fucked up script was an incredibly brave and decent thing for her to do. So I went over to London and spent a day with her. We went through it page by page, and by the end of it that day, both of us knew that something special could be afoot. Then we had the other character is the cop and his Detective Freeman. Philip Jackson is an actor I've been in love with for decades, the same way as I have been with Carrie Fox. And I could never understand why Philip Jackson wasn't a household name. But he has a household face. Everybody knows him and goes, oh, I love that guy. They never know his name, but it's always, I love that guy. And for me, those two central characters in relation to the older relationship was imperative, absolutely imperative that you get that balance right. And I knew once we had the two of them that that element would be taken care of. Then the other two characters have to be essential unknowns. Catherine Walker, who plays Patrick's lover, is a very good friend of mine, and I think one of the great unheralded actors out there. But that's going to change. She just came off 11 months of a major TV show that's about to be released. So, and then for the central role, some of the financiers wanted somebody famous. And we had a kid who was famous, and he was a lovely kid. But he was pretty, blue-eyed, and blonde hair. And for me, there was nothing broken in him. And he had come from a life of privilege. And I needed somebody who was broken when I needed them to be broken. So Mo Dunford came in. Mo Dunford was totally unknown, and I thought there was something very special in him. We communicated in private. I brought him back in for an audition, a callback. He didn't know he was the only callback. And we had discussed everything in private, and he did an extraordinary audition. And half the producers and financiers were convinced, and the other half were still wondering if he was up to the job, and they asked, can he be soft? So Ireland was playing a football match that night. I thought, this is a 25-year-old kid. He's very close to magic here. We need to seal the deal. So I brought him home to my house. There was a whole bunch of my mates there. We all got drunk watching the game. We got him drunk, and I got a beautiful dog. Willow is her name, a collie, Labrador mix, big affectionate dog. I got Mo Dunford drunk, brought him in, sat him on the couch, let the dog lick his face and jump all over him, and I filmed it. And I sent it in the next day, and the financiers said yes.
Right.
So literally, it was a dog who cast Mo Dunford.
That's quite a story. But even still, that's amazing, because his performance in particular is just vital to the film and to its effectiveness.
Well, it's interesting because Mo has a personal experience, a familial experience of schizophrenia itself. So there's that knowledge that comes from a place that is not born out of research. It's simply experiential, and you can't fake that. But secondary to that, we went through it moment by moment. And what's amazing about Mo is that once he decided to trust me, he was able to fly.
Right.
Because once he knew I would catch him if he fell, everything was fine. So he had the courage to take it to the most extraordinary places, the most extraordinary raw places. But also, I'm an acting teacher, so I've taught thousands of actors, and I love working with actors, but particularly actors who are not as experientially crafted as they may be, but who have a courage. And if you can introduce somebody to their own capacity, a capacity they themselves didn't know they had, to watch them discover that live on camera can be transformative, not just as a director, but also for an audience, because you're capturing that moment of discovery. And Mo is one of those astonishing, instinctive actors who has subsequently become very crafted, but his instinct is so astonishing that he somehow manages to communicate with an audience, despite the fact that he's trying to conceal what he's feeling.
Right, yeah. We talked about one of the central themes being the right to intimacy, but the way in which the audience feels that intimacy, I think, was also true in the visual style, and I was also able to admire that there was a lot of close-ups and there was a lot of attention given to the actual facial expressions of the characters and the actors. Was that a choice that you were always conscious of?
Well, the simple thing is that, you know, the old cliche that the most interesting landscape in the world is the landscape of the human face. When you got faces like Kerry Fox, faces like Philip Jackson, faces like Catherine Walker, faces like Mo Dunford or Aaron Monahan, many of the supporting players, to me, are great actors in their own right as well. But when you have those kind of faces and you're dealing with psychological and emotional truths and trying to discover those truths, as I said, live on camera, which is the idea of capturing lightning in a bottle, why would you have some kind of aesthetic distance? Or why would you impose a limited camera movement on it so you can demonstrate your directorial aesthetic? To me, it makes no sense. It was all about being uncomfortably close to a realm of intimacy where people were becoming increasingly uncomfortable with their own proximity to each other. And Michael Lavelle, the wonderful cinematographer Michael Lavelle, we sat down and we broke the script down into his visual language, but we never did a storyboard or any of those things. Because I said to Michael, look, we got to know whose point of view we're at what stage. We got to know how memory is being affected in relation to the characters and how we're manipulating the memory of an audience. And once we have that language in play, we're going to repeat it 3 times. So you present something, then you present its opposite, then you present its subversion. And that's the language of the film, the language of it, thematic language, but also the visual language. So we wanted to make sure that those moments where you want to look away are the moments where you are forced to come even closer. Mm. Because that's the nature and the danger and the excitement of intimacy or sexuality.
Did things get any easier since Charlie Casanova, let's say, or have things gotten easier on that scale, or is it still pretty hard to get a film off the ground?
Well, it's interesting because the fundamental principle doesn't change. Like, I've been on big, big budget films, and not in the capacity as director, but as actor or as whatever. I've been in small roles in huge films, and you see, you know, it's a $120 million movie. And once action is shouted, it doesn't matter what the budget is. It's all about, within that frame, trying to capture that moment that will live throughout the whole post-production process, the editing process, and eventually, in a dark room, you hope its power will still manifest in the viewer. So in terms of getting a movie made, it's always difficult to get a movie made. Charlie Casanova was made for next to nothing, and it was a very angry, abrasive, polemic film. It was designed to be that. It was a punk rock film. We didn't realize that the provocation was going to become so extreme, that the attacks on me were going to become so personal. But at the same time, it would have been naive of us to think otherwise, because if the film had not caused the level of havoc it caused, it would not have been the film it was supposed to have been. Charlie Casanova is about a bunch of emotionless, ugly, vacuous people. Patrick's Day is the antithesis of that. It's a profoundly humanistic, profoundly emotional, profoundly complex series of engagements that escalate to a realm where you hope it becomes unbearable, but that you can't stop watching, that you're so emotionally raw from watching it that you have that kind of cathartic release. That's the whole function of it. So it's the opposite of Charlie Casanova. But in terms of getting it made, I had the script. Tim Palmer, the fantastic producer Tim Palmer, saw Charlie Casanova. We were at a small festival together. He saw Charlie Casanova, and all the things that people hated in it, he loved in it. And it seemed to that Charlie Casanova always divided people in that way, but the champions of it really championed it. They saw something. Tim saw something, and Tim is a massively experienced producer. But the thing that he saw in it, the voice that he saw in it, he thought if we articulated that in Patrick's Day, it could be extraordinary. So I said to him, look, give it 6 months. If you don't have the money in place in 6 months, I'm shooting it on my phone. And it wasn't an idle threat or a swagger. It was literally, I have to make another film, and I got to make it no matter what. Less than 6 months, Tim got the money together. And he got it from Northern Ireland, England, and the Film Board. The Film Board were particularly generous here. So it's interesting that through Charlie Casanova, people think that I have some kind of chip on my shoulder in relation to the Film Board. I never did have. Just because the Film Board didn't support it, I totally understand why they didn't support it. And in the end, they did. They helped with the cinematic release. But the Film Board were incredibly supportive here, particularly Rory Gilmartin, who pushed us on every level. But he always pushed us to try and get better for the film. So it's because of him, for example, that we had even the temerity to consider approaching Kerry Fox. Those kind of things. So everybody involved in the film, I hate to sound it, I don't want your listeners thinking that it's all hold hands and sing Kumbaya, my lord, but we had an extraordinary cast and crew of people who just, it was on the second day, in fact, Some of them very, very experienced people, but there's always a moment in a film where you realize this is going to be a piece of shit, or this is going to be something interesting.
Right.
Then you hope there's a moment in the set where everybody feels, whoa, we got to up our game. This is going to be something special. And that happened on the second day, and everybody upped their game. And a major part of it was because of the actors. But even stuff like sound recording, Hugh Fox is our sound recordist. And suddenly you see this guy who's a technical genius and a complete professional and all these things. And suddenly you see him having to up his game on every level because he's going, I can't keep up with this. These guys are either going to make a total piece of shit here or they're going to make something remarkable. And that courage, again, from cast and crew, where everybody feels like they might be a part of something special, that's infectious. And it was a very short shoot. I think it was 17 days or 18 days. But in the time frame that we shot it in, every moment of it felt, with almost no exceptions, like we were all part of something really remarkable that was bigger than us and more important than us. And that's exciting.
One of the things that I admired most about this film is that its honesty reminded me of Cassavetes, who was another filmmaker who gave a lot of importance to actors and performances, and also dealt with like such delicate themes and issues. So I'm just curious about like influences and whether you had any for this film, or you have any in particular in general.
Well, Cassavetes is a god. He's a great god. But I think the difference with Cassavetes is that Cassavetes would absolutely script what was happening, but then he had these incredibly experienced actors who were brilliant at improvisation as well, so they would develop it and go through it. Yeah. And also it's kind of elliptical, and there's all kinds of different things that he was trying, whereas with me, the script, and this is where I have my own kind of fascism, the script was untouchable. Mm. You had to say what was written. You had to do what was in the script. Now, if we wanted to change anything, or if somebody requested something, invariably I would say yes. Not because I had any doubts about the script, but because if they're instinctively asking for a change, it's that because at that stage they know the character better than I do. And the change that they're looking for, as long as it's at the very least as good as what exists, are better than what exists, they're only doing you a service. If it's a weaker idea than the central idea, or if it's a weaker suggestion, I'd say, no, it's shit. Go back to the original line. And all of these actors, again, had no hesitation in laughing at that and doing precisely what was requested. So there was no hierarchy or prima donna nonsense. In terms of influences, for a film like this, you'd be looking at someone like Alan Clark, the great Alan Clark. Unfortunately, he's dead now, but those kind of films that he made where you felt you were drawn into a world that you had never been a part of before, and by the end of it, you needed a shower to wash that world off you. Mm. Because it had become such a visceral, physical, physiological experience. And then, of course, there's a lot of different directors who do that kind of stuff, but we wanted to make sure that there was an aesthetic here, a visual aesthetic that belied the raw emotion. And I think that's back to where Michael comes into play, Michael Lavelle. We said we wanted to push the colors. We wanted to push the language of color. We wanted to push, depending on whose perception it was, how do we view color? So, and at the risk of sounding wanky, the palette was green, white, and orange, because the film is a political metaphor for Ireland as well. You insist that it works on a humanistic level, but also I wanted it to be a revelation of the kind of country we're living in now, which is Ireland is, in fact, the single biggest psychiatric institution in Europe. We got absolute scum employing shock doctrine. Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, instead of, we have electroconvulsive therapy in the film, but the same principle applies. These scum in government are engaging in a kind of revisionism, erasing our memory, robbing us of our rights, telling us that it's for our own benefit, which to me is damaging beyond measure, but also the perfect metaphor for the language of the film, which is a fight for individualism, or a fight for the collective or individual right to a better life. And as a political metaphor, we manifested that in the green, white, and orange. So the movie is drenched in greens occasionally, drenched in white, drenched in orange, until the final sequence where it becomes blue, the blue of freedom.
As a final question, I've been to a few festivals throughout the year, and ever since Edinburgh, this film has had a reaction, and it's mostly been a positive reaction. I'd say the majority of people talking about this film have been very enthusiastic about it. But I just wanted to hear it from your perspective. What do you think of the reaction that this film has picked up? You know, because it's been traveling for a while now.
Well, I just got back from Mannheim in Germany yesterday. And Mannheim in Germany has a population of under 300,000 people. This film had 6 screenings in the Mannheim Film Festival. 3,000 people came to see the movie in 3 days. Now that to me is a staggering thought. Well, to walk into a cinema and 500 or 600 people sitting in a room,
yeah,
in Germany, for God's sake, and then for them in the Q&A afterwards, for someone to raise their hand and make a declaration about their private life in public, sometimes a declaration they've never ever said to anybody before, and their voice is shaking and they're reaching out. That is a huge responsibility that I'm not sure we're capable of carrying, but also it's a profoundly exciting facilitation too, that a film, you know, fiction has the ability to cause such power in reality to some people that they feel they have the courage to reach out for intimacy. That notion, because again, the film is not for everybody. There are some people who are not going to like the movie, which genuinely is not a problem. But the kind of movies that interest me are the kind of movies I used to watch when I'd be living in a bedsit, a small little dark room, maybe watching 4 or 5 movies a day, lonely beyond belief, and looking for some kind of salvation in a film or some kind of inspiration in a film to go out into reality and have the courage to do something that I don't have the courage to do. Patrick's Day, for me, if it works on somebody sitting alone in a dark room, either by themselves — I used to go to the movies by myself all the time, so the dark room can be a movie theater, or the dark room can be at home on their computer, on their television, or whatever — if the movie affects somebody there, I'll never know about it, you'll never know about it, but if they shed a tear and they feel empowered to reach out for something, I can't put a value on that.
Right. Well, it's a very powerful film, and thanks very much for joining us and talking to us about it.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much, and this is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.